Hello, everybody. This is Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and organize around the eco-socialist program that my running mate, Angela Walker, and I ran on. And I'm in a classroom at the University of Chicago. You can tell by the chalkboards behind me. I'm at a conference of what's called the Platypus Society, which has been around now for 18 years, and it's mostly students and some professors, and they're debating how to rebuild the left, what happened to Marxism, what needs to be recovered. And I was hoping to pull out a guest from this conference for this podcast, but they're having a plenary right now on the question of free speech in the Trump era. And what was it titled? The Politics of Free Speech. And I was listening to the various speakers, and the one I wanted to listen to most was Jack Weinberg, who was really the key leader in the free speech movement in Berkeley, which really was a significant turning point in the new left of the 1960s. So he's probably speaking right now. And when this podcast is over, I'll go back in there. It's a long plenary session, 2.5 hours. So I'll, catch something of what he said. But I'm obligated to be here. So here I am. And let me just comment on a few things before we get to your questions and comments. The war on Gaza, I mean, it's just unbelievably cruel what Israel is doing. I mean, we know on Monday about the 7 food aid workers from the World Central Kitchen that were bombed. And the Israelis knew who they were. Their cars were well marked. It was supposed to be in a safe zone. They were in communication with the Israeli Defense Force. And yet 3 vehicles were hit, which were spread over a mile and a half by precision munitions. This was no mistake. And they didn't all happen at once. They hit one vehicle, and then the second one went up to help the victims there. It got hit. Same thing happened to the third one when it went up to help the people that were hit. This is a blatant war crime that must be punished. And the same day, Israel bombed the Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria, which is the equivalent to bombing Ukrainian territory. And, the Netanyahu government seems intent on spreading this war to Iran and drawing the U.S. in on its side. That could be not only the death knell for Biden's reelection, which Netanyahu wants. He wants Trump in. But he also wants an endless war domestically, so he can stay in power. His polling numbers are now 15%. He'd love to have Biden's or Trump's low polling figures, which are up, in around 40%. So he's very unpopular. For him, war is the way to stay in power. So, we got to keep doing what we've been doing, out on the streets, contacting members of Congress for a permanent ceasefire, humanitarian aid into Gaza, withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza, and an end to U.S. military aid to Israel until it ends its policies of apartheid and occupation of the Palestinian territories, and until it engages in good faith toward a political solution that would provide peace and equality for all the inhabitants of Israel-Palestine. And the Biden administration, I think partly because of our pressure in the United States and globally, they know they're getting isolated, and they don't want to go down, sink the ship with Israel. And so there's distance being drawn, and there may be consequences if Israel doesn't agree to this ceasefire and the rush of humanitarian aid and the release of hostages. Of course, Hamas has to agree with too, but the indiscriminate killing of civilians. I mean, they're bombing Rafah. They haven't even invaded it yet. I think what's got to stop are the, what the Biden administration said was they're going to have a reassessment. They said they will assess their options. Reassessment has a certain word meaning in the context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But in any case, the Biden administration is feeling the pressure, and we got to keep putting it on it. And meanwhile, Ukraine, running out of ammunition, running out of interceptors of ballistic missiles and drones coming into Iran. The Russians are firing at them, as well as fighter jets. If the air defense system gets so weak, the jets can come in and bomb. They'll carpet bomb cities like Kharkiv and Zaporizhia, like the Russians did to Mariupol, or they've done in the past to Grozny and Chechnya or Aleppo in Syria. That's what the Ukrainians are dreading. And, you know, our idiots in Congress can't figure out what to do. On the Republican side, the Speaker, Johnson, had said as they went on vacation that he'd have a bill for Ukraine aid. He called it standalone, but he was going to add some stuff to please the right wing, like going back to permitting new liquid natural gas export facilities, particularly in Louisiana, where Speaker Johnson's from. And maybe some, you know, harsh border control measures. So it wouldn't be completely standalone, but, you know, he would hope to get enough Republicans and the moderate Democrats, sort of the middle of Congress, to pass that. But Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, said nothing for Ukraine. And if Johnson puts it forward, she's going to activate that resolution to have him replaced. And he will, you know, there are enough folks there to, you know, knock him out of the speakership, and then you got to mess with who's going to be the speaker. Now, the Democrats, for their part, are saying to Johnson, you know, if you get the Ukraine aid passed, put it on the floor, we'll give you the votes for that. We'll also give you the votes to keep your speakership in exchange. And so that's one possible scenario. There was an effort to do a discharge petition, but it's stuck at about 190 signatures. The progressives won't sign it because that's for the Senate bill, which is basically based on Biden's proposal to give both Israel and Ukraine aid in the same bill. And the progressives don't want to give Israel any more weapons to commit more slaughter in Gaza. So it doesn't look like that's going to get enough signatures. So it's really Johnson who's got to decide whether he's going to capitulate to the Republican right wing and then nothing gets passed, or whether he decides he's going to pass Ukraine aid with the help of the Democrats, who also will protect the speakership. We'll have to see. And then the last thing I'll just say is, you know, Trump, the April Fool, you know, on April Fool's Day, that new stock for his social media company, he lost $2.4 billion. On April Fool's Day. And the loss is no joke. The joke is on Trump and his fellow shareholders in the Trump Media and Technology, who thought this small company that was losing millions of dollars last year was really worth several billion dollars. And the stock market valued that company initially when the independent or the initial public offering went out at more than $8 billion. So, you know, Trump thought he made a lot of money and a big windfall. But a week later, there had to be a filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission, and it showed that this company, which was supposedly worth $8 billion, had generated just $4 million in revenues last year. So that's one half or one one-thousandth of what the company's valued at. And they lost $58 million. They only raised $4 million. They lost $58 million. They were about to go bankrupt. So that report about the losses last year and the low revenues created a market value loss of a quarter of the value. From the stock opened at $48, went to $79, but by the next Monday was back down to $48.66. And so, you know, Trump's value, his 57% ownership in that company, went from a high of $6.2 billion back down to $3.6 billion, which is nothing to sneeze at, but I think it's going to go down from there. The stock has no major institutional backers like large investment firms and banks. Hey, they know this is a mirage. Most of the stock's purchasers seem to be small retail investors who are going to get burned. You know, Trump has made a bunch of more suckers. The value is fictitious. A company with $4 million in revenues and $58 million in losses is not worth several billion dollars. So I think the stock value will continue to decline. By the end of the week, it was back down to 40, which is where it was when the initial public offering went out. So now Trump might get permission to sell some of his shares to meet his legal and campaign expenses. But that will dump shares on a on the market that will depress the price further and send signals to other shareholders that Trump is really not invested in the company, which will send the stock down further. This thing is a mirage. And the same day that the stock got crashed, Trump posted his $175 million bond for the civil fraud case, which was somewhat surprising. The guy behind the deal is named Don Hankey, and his Knight Specialty Insurance Company is a fat cat predatory lender. He's worth $1.6 billion, and he made his money on subprime loans, auto loans. And he cleaned up, particularly after the 2008 financial crisis. He has bailed out Trump from financial difficulties in 2026 for Trump Towers in Miami by refinancing the mortgages there. He made two large loans to Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, for real estate. And the reporting is this guy has never met Trump, but has supported him politically. But I think this is about business, because Trump may like, I mean, Hankey may like Trump's politics, but above all, he's a predatory lender, and he may see Trump as his latest prey. So Hankey may be expecting to clean up by acquiring some of the prime Trump properties if Trump can't pay off the bond, when, as most observers expect, he loses his appeal and has to pay up for that bank fraud case, which with interest is going to be over $500 million. So I just think, you know, I called it Trump the April Fool on that day. His stock market crashed, and while he got that bond, you know, in fact, the latest news is the Attorney General of New York is asking for more disclosure as to what's backing this bond, you know, the collateral and or cash. So Trump's not out of the woods, and when he loses his appeal, he's definitely not out of the woods. So at this conference, somebody was arguing that Trump is being wrongfully accused and wrongfully prosecuted, which I, you know, just found to be crazy. It was, I didn't understand the argument. It was something to do with free speech and how the Democrats are politicizing this process. But of course, politics are involved, but Trump is a crook and he's finally getting caught. And I think it's about time. So anyway, that's my little rant. Start this up, and I'm looking forward to your questions and comments. Vicky Corden, it is very upsetting, the tragedy of the World Kitchen humanitarians. I think it was deliberate. Yeah, I think you're right. All the circumstantial evidence surely points to that. You know, you don't hit one, and then you hit another, and then you hit another when this organization's been in touch with your military forces. And it's not the first humanitarian aid workers who have been killed. I mean, a lot of people, particularly Palestinians, have noted, you know, we've lost over 200 aid workers. They've been Palestinians. Now some Westerners get killed by Israel, and it's, you know, it's front page news and everybody's upset. You know, the critique there is we should have already been upset. But it is very upsetting what happened to these humanitarian workers, as well as the earlier humanitarian workers, like with the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, which has been providing humanitarian aid to Palestinian refugees since the late 1940s. And now in this $1.2 trillion aid package or funding package that Congress passed before going on their 16-day vacation for Easter, they banned any U.S. money going to UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Work Agency, which is the main way aid was getting in. And these people know how to deliver the aid in Gaza. So that's upsetting as well. Frankie Lee, how do you think anything will happen to stop Israel from a full-scale attack on Rafah? The U.S. has got to read Netanyahu, you know, the Riot Act, basically, and say, you know, what the U.S. is saying is you got to evacuate the civilians to somewhere it's safe. There's no plan for that yet. And then you got to use, you know, precision tactics. So you're going after Hamas fighters and not civilians, which is really hard to do in an urban environment. That's what the U.S. is demanding. Israel is saying, we're going ahead in Rafah no matter what the U.S. says. But the U.S. does have leverage. I mean, basically, they can say, okay, you do that, then no more arms for Israel. And if that'll hit Israel. That'll be a gut punch to them because they're so isolated in the world. The U.S. is about the only country backing them. Some of the West European countries were sympathetic when they were first attacked on October 7th. But now, after all the slaughter in Gaza, they're losing support there. That's seen in the UN resolutions and the statements by the various countries. Even Germany, which has been so guilty, you know, for the Holocaust and given Israel, you know, a lot of latitude for misdeeds, and the UK as well. So I think, you know, international pressure, particularly by the U.S., could stop Israel. But on the other hand, you know, Netanyahu, just as I pointed out before, you know, for him, the war is the only way he stays in power. If he loses power, you know, and there are new elections and he doesn't, you know, become part of the new government, he faces, you know, a lot of, he's like Trump. He faces a whole lot of court cases, you know, having to deal with corruption. So, yeah, Netanyahu is a desperate man and willing to slaughter lots of people to maintain his power. That's the other problem we got here. But the U.S., you know, needs to really send a strong message by not just talking, but acting. And I think that means just cutting off the military aid, you know, until Israel says, okay, we're going to change our apartheid policies. We're going to end the occupation. And we're going to negotiate with the Palestinians about a real political solution that provides equality and justice for everybody living in Israel and Palestine. Amy L. Sachs, RFK Jr. has declined to debate Jill Stein on the situation in the Middle East, a cowardly Dem who won't face Greens but supports killing overseas. So, quote unquote, brave. Who is surprised? Yeah, RFK Jr. is, he's really moved hard right. I mean, he's appealing to the far right on questions like immigration, you know, close the border, Palestine, total support for whatever Israel wants to do. And of course he won't debate Jill Stein. He's got an impossible position with anybody who's got, you know, any morality and basic facts about the situation in Gaza and Israel, Palestine generally. So it's not surprising he declined to debate because he'd get his ass handed to him. But I think it was a good move by Jill to say she's willing to debate. It got some news coverage. That was a good media hook, you know, because the media mostly doesn't like RFK Jr. So it just gave him, that was kind of a little stick to beat him with, but he's gonna get a lot more because, well, for several reasons. One is he's got terrible positions on immigration and Gaza and public health and vaccines. And the other is, you know, people in the media are worried he's going to take votes from Biden and elect Trump, although the polling is ambiguous on that. Some polling shows he's taking more from Trump as he adopts these right-wing positions. You know, I would just say that people like, you know, Biden, you know, don't, or the media, you know, let the voters decide based on what they hear from these candidates. Don't try to game the system or knock, you know, Kennedy out, you know, with ballot access manipulation and that kind of thing, which he's definitely going to face. Stein's going to face it. I faced it. Ralph Nader really faced it in 2004. I mean, that's, you know, when we could have ranked choice voting. So the spoiler question wouldn't even be a problem. I mean, the thing, if I was running this year, that'd be my top issue, because that's all they talk about when they talk about Stein and West. You know, I get the Google alerts for them, and all the stories are about the latest polls and how West and Stein are going to spoil the election for Biden. You know, the message should be, we got an answer to the spoiler problem. It's ranked choice voting. And if Biden doesn't join us in supporting that and doing something about it, because he's got the power, then He's causing the spoiler problem, not us. That's the kind of argument I think we got to make. Flip the script on the Democrats when they whine about us spoiling the election. Chris Blankenhorn, Illinois just started its 50,000 signatures in 90 days for ballot access sprint. New York starts in a couple weeks. Yeah, April 16th. Comments on the current ballot access struggle and the broader democracy fights Greens need to engage in. I've been saying this since I ran in 2020. We got to make election reform. Ranked choice voting for executive offices, proportional ranked choice voting or proportional representation, which creates proportional representation when you have proportional ranked choice voting for multi-member districts in legislative bodies. That's the key reform, because that will break up the two-party system, which is really one-party systems in most districts where one or the other major party has a majority. So most of our elections are not competitive. 95% of state assembly races and state Senate races are non-competitive. 90% of races for the House of Representatives are non-competitive because one or the other party's got a majority, and everybody knows who's going to win before the election even happens. So they say, why should I vote? I know who won. So those two things, that's a real game changer. And the other thing is fair ballot access. There was a good bill. It was put in by John Conyers called the Fair Election Act in 1989, and it set standards for fair ballot access, which are much lower than most states have now. Still higher than most other countries, but you know, for us like the Greens, that would be, you know, we'd be able to get on a ballot in every state, get our candidates on the ballot to run for the House of Representatives. This applied to federal elections. So that's another reform. And in terms of proportional representation in the House, there's a bill called the Fair Representation Act. That I don't know why they took so long to introduce it into this session, but they did. It's Don Beyer of Virginia, Jamie Raskin of Maryland, a number of others, about seven or eight, including Summer Lee of Pennsylvania, one of the new squad members. And I really appreciate that, because until she signed on, none of those squad people had signed. Still, it doesn't have a lot of sponsors. It really has no chance in this Congress as long as the Republicans are in charge, but it's a bill that we should get behind, you know. So the ballot access fights we should engage in at the federal level, push for a bill to have a national popular vote using ranked choice voting for president. And there's a sample legislation how you could do that without making a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Electoral College that was in the Harvard Law and Policy Review. I believe it was winter issue 2021. When you look up Harvard Law and Policy Review and looking for an article by Rob Ritchie and others, that model legislation is there. So that's one thing. Second thing is we got to get somebody in Congress to bring back John Conyers' old bill, the Fair Representation Act. I'm sorry, the Fair Election Act, for setting federal standards for ballot access that are fair. And then, of course, the Fair Representation Act that I just mentioned, for proportional representation in the House, but also it requires ranked choice voting for U.S. Senate seats, which gets rid of the spoiler problem. Okay, I just saw, there it is. That's the article. That's the article with an appendix on how to a bill that could pass the Congress and create a national popular ranked choice vote for president. Do away with the spoiler problem that we're always attacked on. So anyway, that's my answer to that question, what we can do. And then, of course, at the state level, they're comparable legislation at the local level, you know, for ranked choice voting, particularly proportional ranked choice voting for city councils and state legislators, legislatures, and fair ballot access in your state. You know, all those things, I think, should be high priority for the Green Party. Because until we deal with those things, if we get on a ballot, which is hard in the first place, then we got to face a spoiler problem, which, you know, most progressive-minded people that would vote Green say, you know, I can't risk it because the Republican might get in. And that's the dynamic that keeps us marginalized. And until we change the electoral system, you know, that's just the nature of winner take all single member district elections. So I think that's a high priority. Fair ballot access, ranked choice voting for executive offices, and proportional ranked choice voting for proportional representation in legislative bodies. Vicky Gordon, gerrymandering, money and politics are big problems. Also, when the Supreme Court said money is speech. I agree, those are big problems. Although I think the winner take all single member district problem is the biggest we face. If you go to proportional ranked choice voting, proportional representation, then gerrymandering is largely eliminated because you have multi-seat districts and every political viewpoint gets its fair share of representation and power in proportion to the vote it gets. So it doesn't matter so much where the district lines are drawn. So that already gets rid of gerrymandering to a large extent. That Fair Representation Act that I just described in the House, that requires independent redistricting. Although I have to say, it does, independent redistricting under winner-take-all single-member district elections doesn't make much difference. We've seen that in California, Michigan, and other states where they've done that, Iowa. And in money and politics, yes, that's a big problem. I think the bias, the exclusive nature of winner-take-all single-member district elections is a bigger problem. We could have public financing elections and still be marginalized by the lesser evil dynamic. But it is a big problem. And the thing I'll point out there is we used to in the 1990s have a demand that public elections be fully publicly funded. So once you qualify for the ballot, you get a public grant to run your election and all candidates get the same grant, level playing field, no private money involved. To qualify beside your petition, there was a minimum number of $5 contributions in that concept, which was called clean elections. And a lot of mainstream politicians that first supported it in the 90s, one of them being Joe Biden. In fact, and I've written about this, in his website platform in 2020, first thing he said under campaign finance was he would push a constitutional amendment to get private money completely out of public elections, federal elections, which was the radical position back in the 90s. Now, where the Democrats have gone and the good government groups have gone, they've gone to matching fund systems, which is sort of going backward to what we got post-Watergate for presidential primaries. The problem there is the more money you raise that qualifies for the matching funds, it increases the difference between different candidates, those who barely qualify versus those who qualify with a lot. So it actually increases the differences, and the public money is increasing the differences between different candidates when it's a matching fund system. On the other hand, if there is a matching fund system, you know, Greens can get a nice boost to their campaign financing. The other thing I'll say about campaign financing is at a certain point, once you have enough to get your message out, enough money to get your message out, after that, it's not that useful. In fact, it may alienate people. You know, people get tired of constant advertising, particularly when it's negative, like it tends to be between the Democrats and Republicans. At a certain point, there's diminishing returns on investment to, you know, investing in these political campaigns that have so much money. I'm basically saying, yeah, the private money in public elections is a big problem, but it's not as big as the exclusive nature of our single member district winner take all election system. B.D. Dimmitt. I can't understand how Green representatives' candidates can address the spoiler concept without pointing out the Democrats' Pied Piper strategy that created the possibility of a Trump presidency. Leaving that out cuffs our hands behind our backs every time the issue is raised. The Democrats are entirely responsible for the chance of putting Trump in office in the first place. I guess you're referring to Hillary Clinton urging the media to give Trump, you know, lots of coverage because she felt he'd be the easiest candidate to run against. And the Democrats have continued to do this, like in the Ohio Senate race. The Sherrod Brown reelection campaign apparently had donors give money to the most far-right wacko Republican in the Senate, and he actually did win the primary. So Sherrod Brown thinks he's got an easier race. The problem is the wacko sometimes wins, like happened to Clinton when Trump won in 2016, at least won the Electoral College vote. He didn't win the popular vote, but that's another discussion. Yeah, Greens should, point out that the Democrats, they're not fighting the far right. They're promoting them because they're supposedly easier candidates than mainstream Republicans to defeat. But the more these people are promoted, the more they're normalized, the bigger platform they have, and it strengthens the far right movement. So, yeah, the Democrats, it's not... They share responsibility for the fact that we've got this, far right, Trumpified MAGA Republican Party now. SDR, that's all true, but how do Greens plan to actively stop SACR or Project 2025? You need to tell me what SACR is an abbreviation for. I know what Project 25 is. It's the Heritage Foundation blueprint for a Trump administration. Both of these threats, financing and fueling Trumpism, are going to amount to Atwater's Gilead in real life. I'm not sure what Atwater's Gilead is. Although Atwater was a crook. RCV can wait. Well, I don't know why that follows. I mean, you got to start. If you're ever going to get it, you got to start. And every time, I remember when Nixon ran and people in 72, and, I was being told you got to vote for, who was it that year? Was it Humphrey? Was it 68? McGovern. You got to vote for McGovern because Nixon, may cancel the election. In fact, it was 68 they were saying. If Nixon wins, he's going to cancel the 72 election. So I've been hearing this scare talk forever. I agree. Trump is the scariest yet. I agree with that. But if we just fold up our tents to back the Democrats, like I say, Biden is giving the Trump Republicans, he's normalizing them, giving them legitimacy by trying to do bipartisanship with a party that tried to overthrow him. Instead of accommodating and trying to compromise with the far right, they have to be defeated politically, which means you've got to really attack them head on and expose the folly of their positions, ridicule them, make it so the common sense is, anybody who believes this kind of stuff Trump's putting out there needs to have their head examined, make it unpopular. In other words, fight. And do so aggressively instead of, what Biden ran on. He's going to restore the soul of America by, pursuing bipartisanship with the Republicans. Those MAGA Republicans don't want to restore anybody's soul. They just want to win. They want power, and they will do anything to get it. And, they should not be accommodated or normalized. They should be fought. Waiting for that question. Still zero platform on Biden's website. Yeah, well, we got to be. People in glass houses can't throw stones. Jill doesn't have her platform up. She's got a very generalized principles statement up. I know there's a platform being worked on, but it's been months. It should be up by now. A policy platform is really important, particularly that's why we're in this. The mainstream you know, party candidates, the major party candidates, the corporate party candidates, they're not in it for policy. They're in it for power. And they will say manipulative things. They only take positions on policy issues when they have to, like on abortion. You know, the people want, the majority of people want women to have access to abortion. And people like Biden have had to, quote unquote, evolve on that because he was, you know, very much one of those that wanted to restrict abortion. He supported the Hyde Amendment. Now he doesn't. And that was because the movement put pressure on him, and it became, and now, of course, you know, that's a key issue for him running against the anti-abortion Republicans who want to ban it nationwide. Well, what I'm saying is, you know, these politicians in the corporate parties, they want to avoid taking positions that they can be held to account for. They just want to campaign more on, you know, themes and messaging and values without saying how they're going to get it done. I remember Ronald Reagan in the, you know, 1980 election when he, you know, was running against Carter and we had the energy crisis. And he said, you know, he wanted there to be full employment. Yeah, well, great. How are you going to get full employment, Mr. Reagan? He didn't spell out. And see, that's where you need a media and a press and opposition candidates. They cannot let people like Reagan get away with that, you know, platitude. He wants he's going to give everybody a job, but he didn't say how he's going to do it. He wasn't talking about government being the employer of last resort to create a job guarantee. So that's why, you know, it's important. So platform, yeah, Biden should have one. Jill Stein should have one. I guess she's going to have it soon, but, you know, it's about time that one was up too. Amy L. Sachs, for those who remember Matthew Ho's campaign, a judge in North Carolina has ordered the Dems to pay back some of the money they cost his campaign with their dirty pool. It's in the Charlotte Observer. Yeah, I did see that. Matthew's campaign spent over $50,000 in court. What happened was the Democrat-led state election board, forget its formal name, ruled that, yeah, Matthew had enough signatures, but we think some of them might be fraudulent, so we're going to investigate. And then they investigated until they finally said, well, they look okay, but it was too late then to put Matthew on the ballot. So they played this trick. That's when Matthew's campaign took them to court. And Oliver Hall, very good lawyer, going back to Nader for ballot access, was his lawyer. And they finally got a ruling. Well, first of all, they got on the ballot because of Oliver's work. And then they sued for the money it cost them to get on the ballot. Unfortunately, they spent over $50,000. The money being the judge ordered to be paid back is a little over $5,000. So it's more symbolic than substantive. I wish they'd, you know, got all their money back from this, you know, legal work that should never have had to be done. If the Democratic leadership on the election board had been above the board and honest in dealing with the Greens petition, and they weren't. I mean, not only did they reject the signatures and demand an investigation, there were Democratic officials going around posing as Greens, going to Green homes of people who had signed a petition and saying, the Green Party wants you to withdraw your signature. And others did it saying, we represent the county election board and we want you to withdraw your signature because it might elect a Republican. And, you know, phone calls, you know, robocalls, direct calls, Greens, you know, asked them, well, on whose behalf are you calling? And, you know, they got all these cases. And the judge in the case, when it first came before the, when he ruled that Matthew Ho should be on the ballot, he said the Democrat Party doesn't come here with clean hands. And he said something similar when he, you know, issued this ruling that they should get some of their money back. So a little bit of justice, not full justice, but it exposes, you know, the corruption, the anti-democratic practices of the so-called Democratic Party. And I'll just add that the guy leading the fight against ballot access for Kennedy, Stein, West, It would have been for, what's it, what they call themselves, No Labels, but they've withdrawn. Is a guy named Mark Elias, who's famous for defeating Trump in a lot of his election lie lawsuits around the country, over 60 of them. But he's also, he's only for democracy for the Democratic Party, because he's the guy that coordinated the assault on Nader, which is the worst in history, in 2004. You know, I forget, over 50 lawsuits. They were frivolous, and you know, as one of their leaders admitted, it was designed to drain the Nader campaign of time and money. And Elias, he got the lawyers and went after, you know, my ballot access in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Montana. And he's at it again. The Democratic Party is not very democratic, small d. Thoughts on No Labels not running the presidential candidate? Yeah, they couldn't find, you know, one with their politics who wanted to run. Their politics were like, they were going to be the third corporate party without all the, you know, fuss and mess between the Democrats and Republicans. And they thought they could win it by, I guess, being the nice guys and the straight shooters. But everybody they talked to didn't want to be the one blamed for Trump getting reelected, because the general consensus was, even if they put Republicans at the top of the ticket, Biden would lose, not Trump, whose base is smaller but more loyal, whereas Trump's base is bigger, but a lot of them are having problems with Trump. I mean, with Biden, for a lot of reasons right now, especially what's going on in Gaza. So, yeah, it's not surprising. No Labels is, this has been going on for like 20 years. There's always some well-funded group saying we're going to put forward a corporate centrist. And what they really are is people who think the socially liberal Democrats, who are not economically progressive, are too much to the left. And, of course, the MAGA Republicans are too far to the right. So where they really want to be is with the, you know, the mainstream conservative Republicans, which they call the center, which if you poll public opinion on policy issues like universal health care and Green New Deal to deal with climate change and so forth, they're way to the left of both parties, including the imaginary, you know, centrist majority that the No Labels type of efforts think is out there. But anyway, that makes one thing clear in this election: there won't be a third corporate option, which I think really never had much more chance. I mean, we already got two of them. Why would people go to a third, except for personal dislike of Trump and Biden? So I guess that was their thought, but it didn't work out that way. They couldn't get anybody of the candidates they were seeking to do it. And then one of their leaders, Lieberman, you know, died last week as well. So they thrown in the towel. Amy L. Sachs, Frankie Lee, prominent leftists were slapped down hard after a few of them supported Nader in 2000. Now they are too chicken shit to even hint that they could reject Biden in November. Yeah, the 2000 election really sent a lot of progressives who, you know, after the Clinton years, you know, the corporate leadership of corporate politics of Clinton, and, you know, you know, he wasn't even very socially liberal. I mean, what he did do in that regard was, you know, he responded to public opinion polls. He didn't lead on those issues. After that, you know, a lot of progressive-minded, prominent people said, yeah, Ralph Nader, that's what we need. And, you know, after Gore v. Bush, where the Supreme Court handed the election to Bush, and ignored the fact that, you know, when the ballots were actually counted, Gore won Florida, counted by the media. They took a lot of effort to put together a consortium and looked at all the media by every criteria, counting all the questionable ballots with the hanging chads and so forth. Gore won, but it was stopped by the Supreme Court. Yet Nader got the blame, and the Democrats really pushed that narrative to put everybody back on their reservation, and it worked. You know, they are, you know, the mean-spiritedness and extent of the, you know, shaming of people that had supported Nader was pretty nasty. And so, yeah, a lot of those progressive personalities, you know, they duck. They don't want to get out there and challenge Biden in the election. They may criticize him on this or that policy, and go to a demonstration and give a speech. But when it comes to what counts, you know, votes, things you can take away from Biden that matter to him, they're nowhere to be seen because, you know, of the shaming and ostracism that went to people that supported Nader in 2000. So that's the spoiler effect. And that's why I think it's so important that we challenge it with ranked choice voting and proportional representation. Vicky Cordon, in Florida, the abortion issue will be on the ballot in November. However, there is a 6-week ban. I guess you're referring to the Supreme Court supporting legislation that set a 6-week ban in place. But the whole question will be open on the ballot in November, and it's an abortion rights measure. So the voters of Florida can reverse this. And from some of the commentary I've heard, you know, people, Democrats are hopeful that this issue will swing so many people to the Democratic side on the Trump versus Biden election that Biden could win Florida, which the Republicans have won pretty handily. I think the last time it was won by the Democrats was one of the Obama races, or at least Obama came close. After that, you know, Florida's trended Republican. But this issue may trend that back. In any case, if I haven't looked at the polling in Florida about this issue, but if it's like any the country as a whole, that referendum's going to win. Frankie Lee, Howie, can the public pressure the International Court of Justice to take stronger actions against Israel since the evidence of genocide is overwhelming? Well, I think public commentary has some influence. I think the International Court of Justice is already saying they're telling Israel, what did they exactly tell them? I'm trying to remember. They gave them instructions this week. I think they told them don't invade Rafah and put them on notice that, you know, they are not doing the things the court asked them to do to prevent genocide, which is basically like saying you're going to be on the line for genocide, the crime of genocide, if you don't change your policy. So I think the International Court of Justice is doing a pretty good job of pressuring Israel. Of course, you know, we should praise them for doing that and urge them to say more. But I think, you know, if you got limited time, put that pressure on Biden and your representatives in Congress, because the U.S. really has leverage. The International Court of Justice is more messaging and isolating Israel further, but U.S. cutting off arms and diplomatic cover to Israel would really impact Israel. So I think that's the priority for our activity. Scout Trooper 164. Howie, what do you think the Ukrainians managing to hit? What do I think of the Ukrainians managing to hit oil refineries in Russia? May not limit the draft, but I won't be shocked if it harmed more in the long term. Well, to answer the question, I think it's great the Ukrainians are hitting the oil refineries in Russia. They've done it to an extent that Russia is in the middle of a 6-month ban on exporting diesel and gasoline because they need it for their military machine and domestic uses, which impacts, you know, the finances of the Russian state, which is finances of their military. Now, the U.S. has told the Ukrainians, we don't like the fact that you're hitting Russian oil refineries. Ukraine is doing it with their own homemade drones, not with the equipment the U.S. gave them, where the U.S. said you can't use this to attack anything in Russian territory. So the Ukrainians are doing it with their own thing. And Zelensky said, maybe it was last week or the week before, yeah, we heard the United States, but these are our own weapons, and we're going to do it. And, you know, who can blame Zelensky for saying that? The U.S. can't provide the ammunition, the artillery shells, and air defense missiles that it promised. So why should he, you know, bow down to a demand from I guess it was Anthony Blinken that said it, maybe it was Jake Sullivan. Yeah, I think it was Sullivan. I mean, Blinken, it was over there. In any case, why should they do that when the U.S. isn't providing them arms? And they're in an existential fight. I mean, who is the U.S. to tell them how to defend themselves, especially when we're not providing arms? So that's what I think of hitting those oil refineries in Russia. Now, you say may not limit the draft. I think you mean the new draft law that Zelensky just signed, but I won't be shocked if it harmed more in the long term. Now, what harmed? Is it the hitting the oil refineries or the draft? They need the draft because they need more military personnel. They were overwhelmed when Russia first invaded. They couldn't absorb all the volunteers. Now they have, and they have, you know, a democratic demographic. They have demographic bulge of people who are now in their 40s, but a deficit of those now in their 20s. Because in the 90s, when the shock doctrine, the shock therapy was imposed on the former Soviet countries by the likes of Jeffrey Sachs, who now tells Ukraine to capitulate to Russia, and he's messed up those people in both those countries for terribly. But in any case, because there was a demographic, a lot of people didn't have babies in the 90s because they were too poor. There's a shortage of young men in their 20s. So that's why they, you know, expanded the draft recently. And I'm not sure, Russian draft that's coming. Oh, harm more like the Russian military budget and how it impacts things on the home front. Yeah, the Russian military budget's up, I think it's 57% this year. They're totally on a war footing. War is the health of Putin's state. He's really afraid of being victimized by a popular uprising like, say, Gaddafi was. I mean, yeah, that's why he hates so-called color revolutions or popular revolutions. He's a counter-revolutionary if there ever was one. And he knows the history of Russia. You know, what happened to the Romanovs. Or what happened to a lot of people, you know, in Stalin's circle who didn't bow down completely to Stalin. So he's militarizing Russian society, including the occupied Ukrainian territories. That kind of harm. Yeah, it's a misdirected use of resources. Militarism, ingraining that in the society is detrimental to democracy and to social justice. The militarism tends to go along with nationalism, which in Russia means, you know, the white Russians, not the Asian immigrants from Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. And that is happening right now where Russian state media and the state itself are really scapegoating and arresting Asian migrant workers in Moscow and St. Petersburg. It's been brutal this last couple of weeks since that terrorist attack in concert hall at a shopping mall just outside of Moscow. And I mean, the Russian state, but this is, you know, not unusual. On the one hand, they're saying, oh, the Ukrainians organized it. On the other hand, they're going after Asian immigrants in a very racist way, which is mobilizing the white racists within Russian society. They have a lot of neo-Nazi groups there. Russia's militarism is harming itself, its own society, but also the countries around it that are have to defend themselves from that militarism, and they become militarized. So it's a vicious circle, and somehow it's got to be broken. I mean, the Russian and Ukrainian left are now at the point where they're saying, you know, Putin's either got to, you know, pass on, or we need a revolution to replace the power structure in Russia, because, you know, this militarism and nationalism is how the ruling class now rules. And of course, they want to stay in power. So it's a bad situation. Scout Trooper 164, do you plan to interview anyone who covers the Russian-Ukrainian war, like Artur Rahe, Jake Bro, or the guy who runs the Russian Dude channel? You got to give me more detail. I've heard of the first two names, the Russian Dude channel. Is that the name of his podcast, Russian Dude? Because I can think of a number of Russians who are anti-war, who have now in exile, are doing that kind of thing. I don't have anybody specifically Russian. I do have a Ukrainian who's agreed to come on. And he got back to me and said he wanted to come on today, but because I was here in Chicago, I figured it would be better to have him on another Saturday. So he's picking another Saturday. Dennis Davidov in the Russian Dude is the YouTube channel. Okay, I'll look him up. Dennis Davidov, I watch his his YouTube thing and read his Telegram channel every day. He's good on, you know, basically the ground game of the war, and he's got his own commentary. I don't always agree with it, but I mostly do. I don't know if he'd want to, you know, come on this one. He's got his hands full getting out his every day. He's got to produce. But he would be an interesting guest. That's an interesting idea. So, yeah, I have had Ilya Butrakis, or Rytkus, who's a Russian socialist, anti-war guy that went into exile with the war. I might have him back. I can get him back. But you're right. I should, the political repression going on to Russian peace activists and the left is terrible. There's over 20,000 political prisoners now. Some of them are pretty prominent, like Boris Kagarlitsky. If you look him up, and there's a petition for his release. There are others less well known, but just as deserving of solidarity and support. But Russia's becoming very repressive, particularly for the left. Okay, well, I'm going to get back to that workshop I left, long discussion, see how it's going. Next week I'll be back in Syracuse, and same time, same place. We'll take your questions and comments. I may have a guest, or maybe not. We'll see how things go the next few days. And thanks for being here today, and we'll see you next week.